So again, we are in Acts chapter 23, just to kind of get us caught up. Paul has finished up his third missionary journey when he arrives and he talks to James and the rest of the elders. They ask him to provide for the costs for these men that have a vow, to show that the things that were being Paul was being accused of was not true. So while he's in the temple fulfilling those things, he's accused of defiling the temple, speaking against Moses, speaking against the law, speaking against the people. And we find ourselves now in this whole process of him trying to defend himself, first against the people when they tried to kill him, and then now before the council. Paul then starts off his defense by saying that he's lived his life in perfectly good conscience up to this day. The high priest orders him to be struck. Paul calls him a whitewashed wall because he was struck in violation of the law. And Paul is then rebuked for speaking against the high priest because the law says that you should not do so. And so Paul basically apologizes, proving that he does not speak against the law and believes everything about it. But knowing he's not going to get a fair trial, he then makes the statement in verse 6, "Brethren, I'm a Pharisee, a son of the Pharisees. I'm on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." And that is no different. He believes no differently than the rest of the Pharisees do. The Pharisees all believe that there will one day be a resurrection of the righteous and of the dead, or the righteous and of the unrighteous, of the righteous and the wicked. The Sadducees do not. Therefore, he says this in order to either give himself a fair trial or to kind of put a stop to it. And in the end, what ends up happening is these two parties, it almost appears like they're fighting over him and maybe even pulling him back and forth. I don't know. It kind of gives you that idea when in verse 10 he says that the commander had to go down and take him away from by force and bring him into the barracks because he was going to be torn to pieces. Well, in order to be torn to pieces, you got to have two people pulling in opposite directions, right? So this poor commander has tried on multiple occasions to try to come to find out what exactly is this guy done. And every time something comes up and he is, he's thwarted. So if you remember, Paul told the church at Rome how much he wanted to see them, but he also told them that his prayer for his brethren was basically that they would repent. And yet, time and again, the Jews have refused him. So, and even, you know, he's tried to preach to them, tried to you know, he's even had a chance to speak to the council, and they have all rebuked him. And so some believe that this time period right now, after the commander gets him and rescues him again, to be one of Paul's most distressing times. Paul's extremely discouraged. Paul obviously needed encouragement, or he would not have, Jesus would not have appeared to him. He tells him that just as you've been a witness at Jerusalem, so you'll be also at Rome. So Paul can at least take courage that he's not going to die, at least until he gets there, right? And so we talked about the last time I was here that it was, we don't know this for sure, but more than likely, Paul will be the first apostle to be witnessed to the remotest parts of the earth when he gets to Rome. That then takes us to verse 12, Acts 23 and verse 12. When it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. They came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul." Now, therefore, you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. And we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. So as happens time and time again, when the Jews cannot defeat you through logic and reason and scripture, what do? They just kill you. We'll just silence you. And so that, again, ends up happening to Paul. And I probably should have counted the number of times that there was an attempt on Paul's life, but it's got to be approaching at least half a dozen just that is recorded in the New Testament. This shows the extent of the hatred that the Sadducees had for Paul to be a party of this assassination. The text indicates that they went along with it, or they were going to go along with this particular plot. It is speculated that more than likely the commander, given another chance to find out what the charges were against Paul, would have agreed to it. He's probably thinking, well, great, now I'll finally get to find out what happened. And of course, it would have ended very badly because the commander would not have been expecting it, and him and his troops would have been overwhelmed. Verse 16, but the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him. So he took him and led him to the commander and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you. The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, what is it that you have to report to me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you. So the commander let the young man go, instructing him, tell no one that you have notified me of these things. So this is the only place in the New Testament where there's any indication of Paul's familial relationships, right? We don't know anything about his mother, his father, none of that. But we now know Paul has at least a sister and a nephew. We don't know how old the nephew is. Some seem to think that he is a very young man, maybe even a child, because there is some indication based on what the commander says. But regardless, somehow, and I believe it's through the providence of God, the nephew hears of this particular plot. The text seems to kind of indicate, at least in the Greek, that he was actually there. And so he was an ear witness. He was a witness to the plot. And so the nephew then goes to Paul. Paul says, okay, well, Paul doesn't tell the centurion to tell the commander. Paul tells the commander, let this young man tell him himself, since he is the witness. And of course, the commander tells the young man, don't let anyone know that you told me. Why would he tell him that? A little louder? Yeah, to protect him, because if the Jews found out that, hey, you told on us, it would probably not go well for this young man. Verse 23. And he called to him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. They were also to provide mounts to Paul, to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter having this form. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came upon them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council, and I found him to be accused of questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. When these had gone to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. When he had read it, he asked from what province he was. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive, also giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. So the commander ends up sending about 470 different soldiers in order to take Paul to Caesarea. And the reason for sending Paul was stated in a letter that this commander writes to Felix, the governor, and who lived in Caesarea. And we have talked about Caesarea before. What are some of the things that we know about Caesarea? It's what? So Caesarea was a port city. It was the Roman capital of the region. Jerusalem was the Jewish capital, but Caesarea would be the Roman capital of that particular area. It was built by Herod. It had a man-made harbor. Had all this. It was built by Herod. Very elaborate, place. This is where Pilate lived. And this is also where the local governor, in this case, Felix, lived. Paul has been through Caesarea several times, so he's familiar with this particular city as well. So as we look at this letter that the commander writes to Felix, after his salutation, he makes a comment about how he rescued Paul. And what does the commander say about why he rescued Paul? Sorry. So he says, I rescued him. Actually, he says in verse 27, I came up with them with troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Right? So he's about to be killed. But he says he did it because he learned that he was a Roman. Was that really what happened? No, that was not. So he writes in this letter, making himself look a little bit better than he actually was. Because in fact, he didn't learn of Paul's citizenship until when? He was about to scourge him. Right, which would have been a big no-no. And that's a fact. That fact, of course, he conveniently leaves out of the letter. So he tells Felix about bringing charges before the council because he wants to figure out what's going on. But he says, there's nothing here worth imprisonment or punishment. And so he's confused, trying to figure out what's going on. So he didn't break any Roman law, right? So he then tells him of this plot that he finds about against Paul's life, and he decides that he's going to send them to you, Felix, and let you sort all this out, and the accusers are to bring charges to him. They're into Caesarea. So soldiers bring Paul to Antipatris. This is a journey of about 40 miles. The city was named after Herod Antipas, built by Herod the Great, and it was his father who was Herod Antipater. And so they get halfway there, or at least part of the way there to Antipater, and then the next day they traveled 25 miles and reached Caesarea. And so Felix first wants to know what province he's from, because depending upon what province he's from will determine whether or not he hears his case or whether he turns it over to somebody else. In this particular case, it falls under his jurisdiction, so he will hear the case, but not until Paul's accusers come and bring charges against him. All right, so that takes us to the end of chapter 23. Any questions or comments? Okay, I forgot my clicker. All right, well, I've got some questions for you then. And for some reason, my Dropbox is not wanting to sync up, so I'm going old school. Paper. All right. Question number one, how would you outline the chapter? Anybody want to share what they would come up with? Okay, 1 through 10, Paul before the Sanhedrin. That's what I've got, 11 by itself. Jesus encourages or appears to Paul. Yeah, that's what I've got. A plot to kill Paul, 12 through 15. Yeah, 16 through 22, very good. 16 through 22, I have the plot is discovered, or... the nephew basically rescues Paul, right? What else?
Well, you can either go with he's headed to Felix, or you want to go with you have the letter from Claudius.
Okay, so you could break it up between just the letter, and then Paul is sent, or in my case, I combined them all and just said Paul is sent before Felix, all right, 23 through 35. So that's what I came up with. Again, there isn't necessarily a wrong answer. You might just have, you know, two or three. You might break it up more, but that's what I came up with. Number two, what would you use for chapter headings? I think I personally struggled with this one a little bit on my second point. What would you put, generally we're going to have two, sometimes one, maybe three once in a while, but generally two. I've got two. Well, I put Paul's defense before the council for point number one, which would basically be, you know, verses 1 through, I'm doing 1 through 11, basically. My second point I have down there, the plot to kill Paul is uncovered by his nephew, right? Because that's the majority of the, you know, of the rest of it. But anyway... just try to keep the points simple and easy to remember. You know, you don't want to have too many. And I even don't like my second point because it's kind of long. But anyway, that's what I came up with. All right? Number three, after everything Paul had done before becoming a Christian, how could Paul say that he had lived his life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day? Right. So Paul did what he thought or what he believed was the right thing to do. Okay. Now, can our conscience be wrong? Absolutely. But in Paul's case, he always did what he thought was right. And then when it was shown to him that he was wrong, he then used that same zeal to do the right thing. And so his conscience was clear. He always did what he thought was right. He always did what he believed God wanted him to do. And when he was shown that it was wrong, he changed. He never violated his conscience. Number four, how did the high priest respond to this statement? He ordered Paul to be struck on the mouth in violation of the law. Right? One could not be punished, and this would be considered a punishment, until you're proven guilty. Right? Number five, what did Paul mean when he called the high priest a whitewashed wall? Yeah. And if you remember, Jesus called the Pharisees the same, you know, whitewashed tombs, right? He appeared to be pure and holy on the outside, but in truth, on the inside was wicked and unholy. They would be familiar with the term, this term of being whitewashed, came from Ezekiel chapter 13, verses 10 through 16. So they all knew exactly what Paul meant. And this is similar to when Jesus called the Pharisees whitewashed tombs in Matthew 23 and verse 27. Number six, what were the major differences between the Sadducees and Pharisees? Okay, so verse 8, for the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Now, if you remember during our introduction, what's the easiest way to remember which party remembered what? Because, you know, maybe you get confused and you think the Pharisees don't believe in the resurrection. So what's the easiest way to remember that? Sad. Yeah, so if you believe in the resurrection and angels and all that, that's fair, you see. But if you don't, that's sad, you see. Right? So there's kind of a way to help to remember that. I can remember being taught that as just a wee lad. Number seven, why did Paul cry out that he was on trial for the hope and the resurrection of the dead? And what effect did it have? Okay, so the effect was, the intent was to divide them. To divide them, right? To get at least half of them on his side, right? But why did he say that? So the effect was to get them on their side. But why did he say that? Well, I will tell you that what I have written down here is the resurrection is the key to spiritual life. Without the resurrection, there is no eternal life or death. No reward, no punishment. After death, you just cease to exist. Since the Pharisees believe in it, he knew he could divide the assembly and his trial would go nowhere. And as we will see, he will repeatedly state that the real reason for why he's on trial is for preaching and providing that the Messiah has in fact risen from the dead. And then what I have down for what effect did it have, the Pharisees sided with Paul, if for no other reason, to goad their rivals. They said an angel or spirit might have spoken to him. This caused the fight to almost break out between the two parties. Number eight, did the commander get the information he was looking for? Why or why not? And what happened? This is kind of a little bit of a repeat. I said no. The two parties appeared to have started fighting over Paul. The commander had to go down and rescue Paul before he was torn to pieces. Number nine, who appeared to Paul the following night? What did he say? That is correct. And if we were to put a verse to that, yes, I was thinking more of Acts 1. Acts 1 and verse what? The key verse of the book, of the chapter. A key verse of the book Acts 1 and verse 8, you should be witnesses to Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the remotest part of the earth. So when Paul gets to Rome, he's going to be to the remotest parts of the earth. Verse 10, after Paul was rescued from the Sanhedrin, what did some of the Jews vow to do and what was their plan? How was their plan exposed? Okay, not eat or drink until he killed Paul. And the nephew overheard and told Paul. So I have not eat or drink until he killed Paul. Asked the council to request that the commander bring Paul before them so that these men could ambush them and kill Paul. And then Paul's nephew overheard of the plan and told Paul, who notified the centurion that his nephew had something to tell the commander. Number 11, what did the commander do about it? One more time. He sent him to Felix. That is correct. I have down here told the boy to tell no one what he did, and then gathered soldiers, wrote a letter to Felix the governor, and delivered him to Caesarea where Felix was. Number 12, what the commander said in the letter about what happened entirely truthful? Explain your answer. So easy answer, was it entirely truthful? No. And why was it not?
He didn't find out he was a Roman
until he was about ready to scourge him. He said he rescued Paul when he learned he was a Roman. But in fact, he only learned that Paul was a Roman just before he was illegally bound and about to be scourged. And where did the commander take Paul, and who was he to stand before? Kind of said that already. What city? Caesarea, the home of the Roman government, that province. And to who? To Felix, the governor. Spoiler alert, he will be in Caesarea for 2 years. And he will first stand before Felix, and then he's going to stand before Festus. So now you got to remember, okay, who did he stand to first? Felix, and then he went to Festus. And I always got those, I can never remember which one it was first. still haven't figured out how to remember that. But anyway, I heard something. Okay, you're going to have to be about three times louder. I guess alphabetically, right? I was just thinking maybe for some reason I could think of Felix the cat. Don't ask me why I thought that, but maybe that will work. Anyway, all right, so now your favorite question of all time. Applications, anything that you can think of that would help, you know, anything in here that helped make application to your life, to your walk with God, anything that stood out, any key points, any takeaways from this chapter?
It's okay to stand up for yourself. He stood up for himself. You know, he tried to get free. He did something to help himself. And then also the strong can also be discouraged. Jesus came and encouraged them. And sometimes we think that strong Christians cannot be discouraged, but they can.
So it's okay to stand up for yourself. And strong Christians, people who are at least viewed as strong Christians, do in fact get discouraged, right? Just like somebody who, like the high priest, who is a whitewashed wall, on the outside he looks holy and just and righteous, and wow, you know, this guy, he's good. But God knows who he is on the inside, and you get somebody who it appears strong on the outside, you don't know what's going on in his personal life, you don't know what's going on in his heart, and even people who appear to be strong and can be strong still have times in their life where they are discouraged, maybe even their faith has wavered, maybe even they wonder, God, do you even really exist? Okay, stand up for others as well. Stand up for the weak, especially those who cannot, you know, defend themselves and help themselves. Most definitely. I like it. Love it. Anybody else? I actually had four, but I'm only going to talk about three. Paul's respect for authority. Even though Ananias was a wicked high priest, and he was extremely wicked high priest, Paul showed respect for the position of high priest after learning who he was. And we can do the same thing regarding those who are in authority with whom we disagree with. Believe it or not, we have had U.S. presidents that I have strongly disagreed with. And even in the ones that I'll just say I did not like and oppose everything they stood for, if I ever had the opportunity to meet a president that I didn't agree with, I would still consider it an honor and show him respect. That is something that we as Christians all need to do. And so I will admit, it is a tightrope walk, especially in the U.S., with freedom of speech and everything that we have, to be able to disagree properly. And I would just say, use caution. Paul is encouraged and comforted. Paul was discouraged after the events with the Sanhedrin. Paul was unsuccessful in converting the Jews. Sometimes preachers can get discouraged when they go for a long time with no conversions. Of course, Brandon doesn't have to worry about that kind of thing, right? But the success of a preacher is not measured. Does this sound loud enough? Okay. I don't have my hearing aid in. But the success of a preacher is not measured in the number of conversions, but in whether he faithfully preaches the word, both in season and out of season. And finally, God is in control. Paul had likely lost all hope of ever reaching Rome, but God had reminded even Paul that it was he who was in control. Actually, I'm not even looking at my notes. Paul had long desired to visit the saints in Rome. And for those who are looking for verses, Romans 1, 8 through 13, 15, 23 through 25, and Acts 19, 21. But Paul likely lost all hope of ever reaching Rome, at least in the point of being able to, on a preaching tour, right? But God had to remind even Paul that God, was in control. It was God who saved Paul from the mob, God who saved Paul from being scourged, and it was Paul who put his nephew in the right place at the right time and also put a conscientious commander in charge. I, Darren, sometimes need to be reminded in my most desperate moments that God is in control of my life, no matter how dire the situation might seem. Let's look just real quick at Psalms 27. And with the events lately in my life, I thought this was very fortuitous. Psalms 27, verse 14, wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Yes, wait for the Lord. And then 31 and verse 24, be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who hope in the Lord. Any comments on that?
Just because God is in control doesn't mean bad things don't happen. Bad things still happen, and for wicked men, they took them. But when Stephen was killed, he didn't. But you still have to know that you have to do what God wants you to do, and in the end, that's the way it is.
So, even though God is in control, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to suffer, right? Clearly, Paul was doing the right thing, but Paul still had to suffer. In the end, if we do what is right because of the sacrifice of Jesus, when this life is over, we will get our reward. Okay. Anybody else? Well, I thought for sure we were going to get into chapter 24. We will not. And with that, we will pick up with chapter 24 next week. Thank you.